This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's a lot of slang describing parenting styles these days. The hovering helicopter parent, the demanding tiger mother, or the laissez-faire free-range parent. Now our guest today adds two more terms to that list, the gardener and the carpenter. We're talking with Allison Gopnik. She's a psychology professor at UC Berkeley, a well-known expert on children's learning who writes the Mind and Matter column for the Wall Street Journal. She's also the author of several books, including her latest, The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us. And we'll find out about that new science this hour on The Exchange. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Professor Gopnik, welcome.
Hello. Glad to be here.
How is this different from the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of parenting books out there? The parenting shelf at the bookstore is always full.
Yeah. Well, in a way, part of this book is to argue that the whole picture that comes with that very word, parenting, it's not a good picture of relationships between parents and children. It's not right scientifically, and I don't think it's helped to make parents and children thrive. So even that very word, parenting, is remarkably recent. It didn't really start to show up and become popular until the 1970s and 1980s. Now, of course, being a parent has been part of what it means to be human forever, but that word, parenting, is a kind of strange recent invention, and the picture that comes with it is an equally strange recent invention.
Give us a little bit more on that. And by the way, you say that we don't talk about husbanding or sistering or brothering or wifing, but we do talk about parenting. So what's wrong with that? What's the picture that you say you don't like?
Well, the picture that comes with that word is what I think of as called the carpenter picture. It's a picture that suggests that there's a bunch of things that parents can do, expertise they can get, or tricks and tips that they can get. And if they just do the right things, they'll shape a child who comes out to be the right kind of child, and that means that they'll come out to be a particular kind of adult. It's not quite clear what kind, but the picture is that somehow if you just get enough expertise and you become enough of a professional parent, you'll be able to shape your child to come out the right way as an adult. And the science suggests that that's just sort of the opposite of the real picture about what relationships between parents and children are like. And on top of that, I think it's a picture that's caused tremendous guilt and anxiety and misery to both parents and children. And I think the alternative, thinking about being a parent, is actually both reassuring and liberating for parents.
So pushing back, Professor Gopnik, on those sort of how to raise a child who is successful, happy, kind, fill in the blank, you're kind of pushing back on that how-to, carpenter mode.
Exactly. So all those books that say, here's how you can raise a smart child, or here's how you can raise a successful child, they are very much at odds with what the real science, which is what I do, tells us about children and parents. And this book really came about because I wanted to write something about really exciting new scientific developments in the last 15 years or so, both in evolutionary biology and in psychology. And about the same time, I became a grandmother, so I was plunged back into the world of taking care of children. And there was such a disconnect between the picture that was coming out of the science and the picture that had become so prevalent in the culture, this carpentry, professional parenting, shaping kind of picture.
So, and we'll definitely get into that, because that's what makes this different, is you do look at the science of brain development and evolution and child development and psychology. But one more question about the carpenter parent analogy. So the idea is, you know, if I get the right wood and I get the right tools and I follow the directions properly, my child will turn out like a cabinet, just the way that I built it according to the instructions. Is that where you think most American parents are at today?
Well, I think there's an interesting tension, because I think when you describe it, most parents say, you know, I know that's not true. I know that my child doesn't, you know, that my children are all different and they're independent of me. But I do think that what happens is that at the same time that people kind of recognize that, there's such tension in the culture, there's such pressure in the culture, and from this billion-dollar industry that provides those parenting tips, that they still feel like, but if only I just had the right recipe, I could get my children to come out well. And of course, we all want our children to thrive. That is a deep part of who human beings are. So when someone comes to us and says, here's the formula, here's the way to do it, it's very tempting to take that on. But, you know, a bit like all the diet books, the very fact that there's so many of those books is a good indication that none of them really are doing what they promised to do.
Go ahead, Professor Govnik.
So part of the point about the gardener metaphor, now, does this mean that parents don't matter? Not at all. What the science shows is that parents are absolutely crucial, significant, important to all of human development and certainly to children. But the gardener metaphor is a way of trying to articulate a way that they're important that's different from the parenting picture.
Well, I definitely want to ask you about the gardener and how that works. Without getting into the how to be a gardener parent, because I know you're pushing back on that, let me remind our listeners that you can join us as well. Our guest today is Alison Gopnik. She's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, a well-known expert in children's learning and development. She writes the Mind and Matter column for The Wall Street Journal. Her newest book is called The Gardener and the Carpenter. And let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love your questions and comments about this gardener versus carpenter metaphor that our guest uses in terms of raising a child. 1-800-892-6477. So, Professor Gopnik, a moment ago I described the carpenter parent according to your book. Give us a little more on the gardener parent. Who is he or she?
Well, the idea is that if you think about what it means to be a gardener, one of the things, if you're at least a gardener like me, nothing ever really quite comes out the way that you plan it. And that's true about the problems as well as the successes in the garden. And that actually turns out to be true for a deep reason. And that deep reason is that when you garden, what you're trying to do is create an ecoculture. So you're trying to make good soil, make a kind of protected space in which many, many different things can happen. Many different flowers and plants can flourish as the seasons change. And one of the things that we've discovered in biology is that kind of diverse, varied, flexible system is much more robust. It works much better than just trying to make the biggest, brightest orchid, for example, or to have a monoculture where you use lots of fertilizers and end up with one brand of giant potato. And I think the parenting picture is kind of a formula for trying to create those giant monoculture potatoes, which is one of the things from biology that we know might seem like a good idea at the time, but is a very bad idea in the long run. So the unpredictability, the difference, the variability, the difference among different children, and the fact that each generation creates new ideas, new ways of living in the world, things that we could never have predicted before. The science says that's the crucial thing about parenting. What being a parent does is provide your children with space in which they can create a new world. And that's really the reason for our very long childhood from a scientific perspective.
So I was thinking about this yesterday. Even in a garden, you don't just, you know, put your compost in the soil and so forth. You do water, you weed, you prune. I mean, so what's the analogy there beyond sort of laissez-faire, creating a good space and then just letting it grow?
Well, it's not really laissez-faire. Here's the things that I think evolution tells us that parents were really designed to do. So one thing was to have this unconditional commitment and love to just this one particular child. And if you think about it, that's a little odd from this parenting picture. Why is it that no matter what our children are like, we're tremendously committed and loving towards those children? And that uncommitted love, again, gives this opportunity for something new to happen, something unexpected to happen, for that child to come out however it is that they're going to come out. And another thing that we do is pass on our values to children. And again, that's against this kind of laissez-faire picture. One of the things that we know is very important is that children are incredibly well designed to find out even subtle things about what we believe and what we care about. But of course, children take all of that information and then they use it to create new values, new ways of being in the world. So we pass on our values to our children knowing that they're going to change those values and probably reject some of those values.
Yeah, that's the concept you call cultural ratcheting, and I definitely want to talk to you about that, Professor Gopnik. But I'm just curious, which kind of parent were you when you were bringing up your own three boys? Were you a gardener or a carpenter?
Well, I think like most parents, I'm another one of those busy middle-class parents, and I certainly felt the push to worry about, was I doing the right thing?
Right.
How were they going to come out? I felt that just as much as any parent does. But I think from very early on, my children themselves convinced me that they were going to be different from one another, and they were going to be different from me, and they were going to create something new that was going on out in the world. And I think many people's children convince them of that fact, even if they start out thinking that they're going to be, carpenters. And I did have the advantage of knowing something about the science and knowing that all those things that seemed unpredictable and worrying and full of anxiety are part of what actually makes each generation different from the previous generation.
How did they convince you?
Well, just by being there, all of honoring, unpredictable, surprising selves. And I think part of my experience, the experience of being a grandmother, which I've started to do now, and also part of the motivation for writing the book, there are many great things about being a grandmother, but one of them is it gives you a little more perspective than when you're a parent and you're caught in every day putting out fires. As a grandparent, you can look back and you can see how complicated and deep and profound this act of being a parent actually is, this relationship of being a parent is. And I think it's really selling it short to treat it as if it's just this instrumental kind of work for bringing about an adult of a particular kind. It's actually much deeper, more satisfying, more interesting than that.
What's the bottom line of this, Professor Gopnik, in terms of the day-to-day? How much does being a gardener mean letting your kid make all sorts of choices, some of them not so good? I mean, I hear you on they're all individual, they all need to make their own way, but learning from your mistakes can be dangerous in the teenage years, which is where I'm at, can even be fatal. Mm-hmm. So how do you figure that out? Give us some examples, please, of what this really means and what it doesn't.
Well, if you're thinking about the sort of third tension in what being a parent is all about, is this tension between providing this safe space and having the reason why you provide that space, that safe space, is so that children can explore and take risks. And they're just part of the point of the book is that these tensions are just built into what it means to be a parent, and there simply isn't an easy formula or solution or quick recipe for resolving them. So part of what it means to be a parent is to try to provide safety for a child at the same time that you provide opportunities for that child to take risks. And I think in terms of that balance, it's pretty clear that we've gone in the direction of not allowing our children to take fewer and fewer risks. I did a column for the Journal recently about a piece by an anthropologist pointing out that in many cultures, children were playing with sharp knives by the time they were 4 or 5 years old. And I have to say, I, as a mother, was kind of shocked. When I read this. But then I had like 70 comments from people in their 70s and 80s who had grown up in America, in rural America, and said, well, of course you had a penknife by the time you were 5. Everybody just kind of assumed that where I was growing up, and your dad showed you how it worked, and maybe you cut your finger once, and then you didn't cut your fingers before. So I think it's pretty clear that we've moved in this direction of over-protecting our children from risk in a way that, oddly enough, puts them more at risk. So there's an analogy to what's happened with the rise in allergies. So by protecting our children so much from any possible microbe, we've ended up giving them immune systems that are terrified that any microbe will come. So there isn't, again, I want to emphasize part of the book is when you actually dig down into the science, what comes out, and I think this fits our experience, is there aren't simple solutions to these problems. There's tensions and paradoxes aren't, it's not that those are bugs and if only we got the right technique we could escape from them. They're just built in to what it means to be a parent.
Lots more questions, Professor Gopnik, but let's go to our listeners as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, a very different kind of parenting book called The Gardener and the Carpenter, what the new science of child development tells us about the relationship between parents and children. And the author, Alison Gopnik, draws on the science of psychology, on brain development, on child development, even on evolution, to just reveal some of the difficulties and pleasures of raising children today. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. From Keene, Laura is calling in. Hi, Laura. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I'm listening to this show with really great interest. I have my daughter just came into second grade and my son is in fourth. I am an older parent that was raised in the 70s, which was such a long time ago now. And that I would say as I listen that I am definitely a gardener parent and always have been. And I'm very out of step, I guess, with a lot of the parents and the kids. Mm-hmm. But I'm okay with that because I'm very happy with how my kids are doing. But I have been really struggling with public education. Mm-hmm. And I would love to bring the conversation over a little bit to, you raise your children in this way, but I think we're living in a world where what's going on in public education is very, very moving in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And this has turned out to be a struggle for my children and a struggle for me. And
Laura, it's a great question.
We're feeling a little powerless. Right.
Well, I appreciate it.
And we're feeling a little bit like public education is so in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're going to be gardener parents, what are we going to do about school?
Well, this is great, Laura. And I think somebody in your book is quoted as saying, Professor Gopnik, how do you be a gardener parent in a carpenter parent world, especially in schools, which, some people say are too rigid? I love the question, Laura. Thank you so much. What do you think, Professor Gopnik?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And again, one of the reasons for writing the book was that I've talked a lot to people in the early childhood education preschool community. And ironically enough, when you're asking what's a good example of what a gardener parent would be like, a great preschool is a wonderful example of what that kind of relationship between parents and children are like, where children are free to play and explore, and they have these attentive, loving parents who were looking after them in the form of the preschool teachers. And yet there's more and more pressure to make those preschools and even kindergarten and first grade more and more like school, more and more academic, more and more structured. And in fact, we seem to be going in exactly the opposite direction from the point of view of education that the science would suggest is will allow the children to learn as well. So schools are becoming more directive, and they're becoming more directive for younger and younger and younger children.
Is it okay at a certain age to get more directive? I mean, at some point, people need to learn, U.S. history.
Well, that's one of the interesting things that I talk about in the book. There really seems to be a kind of biological difference between children up to about the age of 6 and 7 and then 7 on. So in that early period, which, as I say, is early, but goes to up to 6 or 7, and in places like Finland, early childhood education continues until 6 or 7. In that early period, this free exploration is particularly important. That's how children become creative and innovative and flexible. Now, by the time children are 7 or 8, they really are taking on the skills of their particular culture and society, and it's really important for them to learn in this more directed way. But even then, the way that children seem to learn best is through a kind of apprenticeship where they have someone who's really skilled at something. They can participate. They can become skilled themselves, kind of the way we teach.
And Professor Gopnik, sorry, I got to jump in on you there, but I definitely want to ask you about apprenticeships and how kids learn by watching or doing. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new book on how kids learn and what it means for parents. Our guest is author Alison Gopnik, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. She also writes the Mind and Matter column for The Wall Street Journal. Her newest book is called The Gardener and the Carpenter, what the new science of child development tells us about the relationship between parents and children. 1-800-892-6477. How do you see yourself in terms of these approaches that our guest talks about? Are you more of a gardener when it comes to parenting, or more of a carpenter? How were you raised yourself by your own parents? And what do you see around you? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Professor Gopnik, I have an email here from Susan in Keene. She works with children. She says she's been working with families, infants, and young children for many years. She says children are joyful when they overcome obstacles by themselves. And in allowing them to do this, we prepare them for the real world in which we all live, one in which perseverance, tenacity, and self-awareness are the most powerful gifts of all. Susan, thank you so much for the email. Professor Gopnik, what do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think one of the problems that we see in the school system, and we sometimes see with parents, for parents as well, is the kinds of qualities that letting children do things on their own develop, things like innovation and creativity and perseverance, they're hard to measure on, say, an academic test. So if you want someone to do one particular thing, it's true that directing them and shaping them might get them to do that one particular thing. But if you want children to develop these broader skills that let them cope with new environments, things that they haven't seen before, then that's not the best way of doing it. Letting children explore is a much better way. And, you know, going back to the question about what can parents do, I think, again, part of what's reassuring and liberating about this picture is that children learn best by just interacting with parents as they do the things that they would do anyway. So especially young children learn by watching you cook or go shopping or read or sing or garden or do whatever it is that you do, the things that are important to you, by being yourself, by actually going out into the world and expressing the values that you have rather than trying to turn yourself into this other parenting person. That's actually the best opportunity for children to learn. And children's learning abilities are so spectacularly powerful. They really can do almost all the work.
Well, there's an interesting example in the book, an experiment that describes exactly what you were talking about and what Susan, our emailer, was talking about, where the teacher showed kids how to do certain tasks in two different ways, right? In one case, she said, "Let me show you how this toy works." In the other case, she said, "How does this toy work? I don't know. It's kind of weird. What do you kids think?" Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so this is a very vivid experiment, but there are actually a number of ones that are like this in the book, contrasting children's exploration and play when they're simply given a new toy, let's say, and when someone tells them, "Here's my toy. I'm going to show you how it works." And what they discovered was that this very small change in what the experimenter said made a big difference in what the children did. So when the experimenter said, "This is my weird toy, I don't know how it works," the children themselves explored the toy and found out all the different things it could do. It was a complicated toy that had, you know, four different tubes, each of which did something different and unexpected. When they heard the experimenter say, "This is my toy, I'll show you how it works," and she squeezed one of the tubes, all they did was squeeze the tube over and over and over and over again, and they didn't figure out creatively all the other things that the toy could do. And I think there's quite a lot of evidence that this kind of focused direct instruction narrows the range of options that children are willing to consider. And that kind of exploration and play is the key to flexibility and creativity and resilience later on. There's a whole chapter about play in the book, and I think, again, it's one of those things where we all sort of have the intuition that play is good for children and children are learning through play. But, you know, by the end of the day, by the time you've done homework and Kumon and Mandarin training and and soccer and all the rest, it just aren't enough hours in the day to say, okay, go out in the street and come back when the streetlights go on as a previous generation did.
And well, as you talk about, you know, the importance of exploration, and that example that you give is so relevant, in a time crunch, you know, it's, let's imagine you're a teacher with 25 kids or a parent with two or three kids even. It's a lot faster to just say, this is how you do it. I mean, a teacher with 25 kids, where does he or she find the time to, you know, let every single one of those 25 kids approach the problem in a different way and then assess and assist if need be? I mean, it's tough.
Yeah, it, well, there's no doubt about that. And one of the other points of the book is that I think a really crucial part of this is that we need to provide more resources for this process of being a caregiver, more generally beyond parents, to happen. And one of the evolutionary lessons is that we have a much longer childhood than any other species, twice as long as, say, our closest primate relatives. And literally, since we've been human, a big part of being human has been investing in those children. And we need to, in fact, ironically, at the same time that we've got this billion-dollar parenting industry that doesn't do much good, we aren't providing the basic resources for things like education and early childhood education and paternal leave and so forth that would actually enable this parenting process to take place. So we're putting all this money into things that at best don't make a difference and at worst make lives worse for parents and children, and we aren't putting the investment into the kind of basic support and resources that would allow this kind of garden to take place.
Again, our phone number for you to join us with Professor Allison Gopnik on her new book, The Gardener and the Carpenter, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mackenzie's calling from Maine. Go ahead, Mackenzie. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for the guest is, beginning at infancy, what is her professional or personal opinion on parenting styles, like something like the attachment parenting versus the cry it out method, and how those months and years will affect a child later on in life and their learning style?
And do you have little kids, Mackenzie?
I just had my first son. He's 4 months old.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations. So
thank you.
Worrying and wondering about what's the right way to go in terms of that crucial time when you really need some sleep and you're not sure what you should do. Is that where you're at, Mackenzie?
Well, there's just a lot of different parenting methods for even babies this young.
Yeah.
Whether it's the attachment parenting is a specific philosophy that I've been really interested in, and the idea is that by keeping your babies close and giving them a lot of security at this young age, they become more independent and more secure. But there's a lot of people also saying that it can create very dependent children or people who are basically the opposite.
Oh,
wow. So I'm wondering if she has any ideas on that, on how infancy and things like that can affect later on in life.
Yeah.
Mackenzie, thank you so much. And boy, I remember those days, and you're just bombarded with advice and you just don't know what to do. And you've got this baby and you want to do the right thing. And it's hard. Thank you for the call, Mackenzie.
Yeah. One of the points of the book is that, and again, I think this should be reassuring for parents, is the kind of, it's certainly true that infancy is important because it sets the stage for the rest of development. But the kind of things that are important in infancy are the things that we do anyway, you know, the kind of love and affection and caring that comes naturally to at least most of us when we have a baby. And the small details that parenting focuses on, like do you co-sleep with your babies or do you let them cry it out, or, you know, does the stroller face front or does the stroller face back, or do you, you know, give them solid food at one age or another age, all the evidence is that those things don't make any difference in the long run. There's no evidence that those small, intentional decisions about exactly what policy we're going to have end up affecting our children in the long run. So I think the decisions about those things have to be made on the basis of what makes you and your baby thrive. So, you know, I co-slept with my babies, but that was mostly because I felt that it was a lot more comfortable than having to get up in the middle of the night and listen to them cry. But someone else who doesn't sleep as well might take the opposite view. And what makes a particular baby and a particular parent, all of whom are completely different from one another, what makes them thrive in the moment, that's the thing that I think the science suggests is most important. And the idea that there's a particular formula which will make your child dependent or independent, there's just not very much scientific evidence for that. So if it feels right to you to co-sleep with your baby, then that's the best thing to do for you. If it feels right to you to let the baby cry it out and sleep train the baby, and that works with that particular baby, then that's the best thing. That's the best thing for you. The differences that matter, the things that are really important, whether you provide a loving, warm, secure environment for that baby with, you know, I always say young children really need is mud, livestock, and relatives, which are things that are hard for all of us to give them nowadays, but things to explore, people who care about them. Those are the things that are important, and although those things aren't easy to do in one sense, they're hard to do because you have to wake up in the middle of the night and invest. In another way, those are the things that kind of come naturally to people that follow their intuition.
Wow. So, Mackenzie, you know, it sounds like you're saying to her, Allison, do what feels natural and right to you and throw the books out the window.
I think that's pretty much the message. Now, you know, sometimes books can be, I think part of the reason why there's so many books is we're not anymore in a world where we have a big extended family of grandmothers and cousins and aunts who we can come to for, you know, a specific suggestion when things are going wrong. So sometimes the books can have practical advice. But I think insofar as the books are saying, if you do this now, then your baby is going to grow up to be dependent or independent or happy or not happy, I don't think there's much scientific support really for any of that, aside from the basic fundamental things like having your baby, loving your baby, passing on your values to your children. And you know, my summary of my advice is you trust your intuitions, muddle through, and hope for the best. And I think the evidence is that most children come out pretty well at the end of that process.
Well, and I appreciate what you're saying about people used to grow up in, you know, big extended families, people close by, maybe even generations living on the same farm or whatever. And so we maybe were more confident in previous generations because we had more experience with babies and children and there were people to turn to for advice. Now it's sort of we're a little more isolated. We have children later. So we rely on these books, but the books sound like they're more along the carpenter mode.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I think that's the reason why this word parenting started showing up in the 70s and 80s was because really for the first time in human history, we had a generation of parents who hadn't actually taken care of children before when they were parents. So part of the fascinating evolutionary story is that we really evolved to have children be cared for, not just by their biological mothers, the way that chimpanzee mothers, for example, care for their children, but from the time we became human by fathers and grandmothers and a big extended network of people, including older siblings, so that for most of human history, by the time you had a child yourself, you'd had lots of experience taking care of children and watching lots of other people take care of children. And I can really sympathize with, you know, 30 or 40-year-old person who spent a lot of time working and going to school suddenly has a child and thinks, oh, this is like working and going to school. If only someone would give me the manual.
How many people have said that? Give me the manual.
I could accomplish that. And there's a deep reason, and I think ultimately a good reason why there isn't a manual. There isn't a manual for most of the things that are most important and satisfying in human life. And I think that's especially true about our relationship with our children.
Well, Mackenzie, good luck to you, and thank you for calling. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Bill's calling in from Manchester. Hi, Bill. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
So two sort of opposite end questions. One is, what is the relationship between this gardening notion and the Montessori approach to teaching in the preschool and elementary schools? And at the other end is, the other example is an engineering discipline. As you get further on in your education, there's an enormous amount of emphasis on standing on the shoulders of giants, which is very prescriptive. You're learning based on all the learning that's been accumulated over the millennia to become a really good engineer. And could you help me understand the gardening approach versus carpentry, Montessori, and advanced post-secondary education?
Bill, thank you. Great question. Go ahead, Professor Gopnik.
Yeah, I think that is a great question. And I think, again, if you look at great early childhood education programs like, and there are lots of different varieties of these. The Reggio Emilia program in Italy is one that I particularly like, but there's Montessori and Waldorf and child study centers, and they're all very different from one another. But what they have in common, I think, is that they recognize this kind of garden picture. And after all, kindergarten started out very explicitly being called a garden for children rather than preschool, which is what we think of it as now. So I think there's lots of examples of what this kind of caring for children looks like. And it's, you know, it's not cheap. It's expensive. It takes people who are dedicated and have some training to make it happen. But I think we can see the benefits in terms of things like creativity and innovation. And it's interesting that in terms of, say, university education, and I'm also a professor and a teacher at university, one of the things that we see is when you get to graduate school, which is when you're really learning your profession, the way that you learn is through this kind of apprenticeship method. So my students are taking a little part of my research and figuring out how to do it. And that's very different from the way you typically learn in school and even the way you learn in undergraduate education, where someone is telling you things. And I think engineering is a good example where the context in which you really learn is when you're an apprentice, when you're watching someone else and trying to figure out how they do it and doing it yourself and getting feedback. And I think that's a very good model for later education. That shouldn't just be something you do in graduate school. That should be something that's starting in third or fourth grade, starting in middle school, that children are getting a chance to really become skilled apprentices.
So you learn by being an apprentice, so to speak. But part of that apprenticeship process, you write about Professor Gopnik, involves something called cultural ratcheting. So you learn from your elders, you build on the shoulders of previous generations, as our caller says. But then you write that children are primed, and now I'm talking about teens and young adults, primed to do what's called cultural ratcheting. They don't just imitate their elders exactly. So go ahead. What is cultural ratcheting?
Well, this is the idea that one of the things that, again, made us distinctively human is this capacity we have for culture. So it's a very distinctive thing about us that each generation can both learn from the previous generation, learn all the things that the previous generation has figured out, and can also innovate, can also take all that learning that they did from the previous generation and figure out something new, figure out a new thing to do, a new way of organizing their society, a new technology. And again, we think about new technology now, but that's something that we've done as long as we've been humans. And interestingly, the very things that, I think you said you have a teenager, the very things that make teenagers difficult, the fact that they're rebellious and insist on doing the opposite of what you tell them, that's also the thing that lets teenagers be at the cutting edge of this kind of cultural change. And in work that we've done in our lab, we've shown that teenagers, kind of like preschoolers, are very good at learning something unexpected and new, especially in social settings, a lot like, and in a way that adults aren't. So as an adult, it's very easy to become sort of stuck in doing the thing that succeeded in the past and just continuing to do that. And childhood and adolescence are times when we can break out, when we can try out different ways of being in the world. And that cultural ratchet, that shift from each generation to the next, even though it can be a painful part of being human, is also the part that lets us make progress.
Well, coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about cultural ratcheting, including how a gardener parent would approach the technology with this digital generation. There's some issues around that our guest writes about. All of that coming up, and your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, a new book on how kids learn, drawing from psychology, evolution, and child development. Our guest is author Alison Gopnik, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. She also writes the Mind and Matter column for The Wall Street Journal. Her latest book is called The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. We're learning more about that science, how it informs the process of being a parent, the process of raising a child. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. And just before the break, Professor Gopnik, we were talking about this idea of cultural ratcheting, the idea of, if we just imitated our elders and the learning stopped there, there'd be no cultural progress at all, no scientific progress at all. So you say each generation adds to the knowledge and expertise of the previous one by doing things in a different way. Generational change, you say, is a universal and pervasive feature of human development. How does understanding this idea of cultural ratcheting, that kids just aren't going to do it exactly the way that you did it, how does this help parents?
Well, I think it helps parents to deal with the fact that that sometimes bewildering changes in, say, what teenagers are doing, both their positives and their negatives. And I think the fact that what you're doing is providing a set of values that's really a jumping-off place for your children, rather than thinking that what you're doing is shaping them to come out a particular way, can help to calm some of the anxiety that parents feel when they do see their children doing things differently than the way that they did them.
What if you feel like they're jumping off too far?
Well, you know,
too far from those values.
Right. Again, I think the point is not that somehow you leave children alone in, you know, the jungle and let them get on with it. The idea is that the way that you pass on your values to your children is really by exemplifying those values, by letting them know that this is what's important to you and what you care about, and this is the way that you want life to be in your household at this moment. But I think parents need to do that, knowing that in the long run, that will be the thing that will give children those values, even if in the short run it looks as if the children are doing something that looks very different.
Well, and you write how a major concern that many parents have these days is the pervasiveness of technology in their kids' lives. You talk about some parents, many parents, who are what you call digital pessimists. What are they worried about?
Well, I think there's a lot of worry, almost to the point of panic, that the new technologies that we see developing, the screens and the phones and the internet, are somehow going to have long-term, really, really bad effects on children's development. And the truth is we won't know for another 20 years what those effects are going to be on children's development. And maybe this time will be different from all the other times in human history. But I think getting a more scientific and historical perspective, especially thinking from this kind of cultural ratchet perspective, you can see that every time there's been a new technology, there's been a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety around that technology. And the reason is that new technologies really do change the way that people think and function. So that part's right. But when you look at history, most of the time what happens is as each new technology is created, people figure out how to deal with that technology in a way that's empowering rather than being diminishing. Socrates, the great philosopher, thought that writing was a terrible idea because if we wrote, then we wouldn't remember things anymore. No one would know all of Homer by heart, and we wouldn't be in an active dialogue with other people. We'd think that books had all the answers. And, you know, he was right about both those things. Not very many people have committed all of Homer to memory anymore, and we do have a tendency to think that books have all the answers. But overall, we think that writing was a good idea, and printing was a good idea, and books were a good idea. So I think part of the reason why there's so much anxiety, and this is again where the science comes in, is that if you try to master a new technology as an adult with an adult's brain, it's really difficult. It's distracting. It takes a lot of attention. It takes a lot of resources. And I think all of us now as adults are coping with the sense of divided resources we get when we have to deal with a screen or a phone. But when you master that same technology when you're a child, you're doing it with a brain that's very plastic, as neuroscientists say, that's very good at picking up new information in a much more spontaneous way. And one of the ironies is we all feel as if the technologies that we grew up with when we were children aren't technologies at all. They're just part of nature. So when I'm walking down the street, I'm not getting terribly distracted every minute because, oh my goodness, there's this letter that I have to decode. Is that an A or is that a B? I just do that automatically because I learned how to read when I was a very young child. And my guess, and it can only be a guess for anyone at this point when I see my grandchildren, is that they'll have the same relationship to the new technologies of the phone and the internet. Now, again, you know, part of being an adult is passing on your values. So I hope and I think that my children have the value of loving books, too, because that's a value that I've passed on to them.
Or getting outdoors, for example, spending time outdoors instead of, you know, staring at the screen.
Right.
Six
and,
hours
you know,
a day.
The truth is for adults, one of the things we have to do is figure out how do we keep from just staring at the screen and going outdoors. So I think it's perfectly right to say, come on, let's get out into the real world. Let's read a book or let's do something rather than be on the screens. But I think that's just true for everybody, and trying to adjust to a new technology is something that each generation has to do. I don't think there's any reason to believe that this time is the different, special time that's going to be the end of civilization as we know it.
Well, and it is interesting in the book, you know, not only pulling on the science, but pulling on some history here, talking about Socrates, who thought writing was a dangerous new technology. There's a little quote here. If men learn this, it will implant forgetfulness in their souls. They will cease to exercise memory because they rely on that which is written. And then later in history, as you write, Professor Gopnik, people thought that the novel was a terrible invention. You've got kind of a funny bit here about the device that this girl was given when she was only 2 years old. It had sophisticated graphical interface, sending signals to her optic nerve, sending her brain to an alternative universe. I have to admit, you had me here. I thought it was about a two-year-old who'd been given, you know, a phone with lots of games on it. But it's you reading a novel.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about in the book is if you described my experience with print as a child, you'd say, my goodness, this poor child, you know, I would sit for 5 hours completely oblivious to everything else that was going on around me. And here's an admission, even as an adult, I'm kind of a print junkie. I need to have my books. I get pretty panicky if I have to get on an airplane and I don't have anything to read. Now, when you hear that story, you think, oh, well, that's good. I mean, you know, that's a great thing. You'd want your children to be like that. But again, I think, you know, one of the things I say in the book is the day before you were born always seems like Eden, and the day after your children were born always seems like Mad Max. The thing that you grew up with, like print, which is actually a really powerful technology, one that we know literally changes your brain. Big chunks of your brain get devoted to print, and if you see print and you're a reader, you just automatically have to read it. You can't help yourself. All those things, if we use them to describe the new technology, would seem very threatening. And print did change the way that we went about the world. But I think most of us feel like books were a good idea, and a childhood that was spent completely absorbed in novels was not such a bad childhood.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is professor and author Alison Gopnik. Her new book is The Gardener and the Carpenter, What the New Science of Child Development Tells Us About the Relationship Between Parents and Children. And what is that new science, Professor Gopnik? We've touched on it here and there, but what is that new science of child development?
Well, there's really two lines of work that I talk about in the book that have developed over the last 15 years. And one of them is all this really fascinating work in evolutionary biology about why childhood developed at all, work that emphasizes the fact that this long period of childhood and the abilities for things like cultural ratcheting that it enables are a very distinctive part of what being human is all about. And along with that came inventions like grandmothers that helped to take care of those helpless children. So, in fact, I'm relatively unique in evolutionary history. Most animals don't live past their fertility, and human beings have done this from the time they were hunter-gatherers. So we have all these adaptations for taking care of, investing in, caring for those children in that long period. And the evolutionary story about that, all the changes that meant in who we are as human beings, is really fascinating. The other piece, which is the kind of research that I do, is about how good children are at learning from other people just by observing them, watching them, playing, doing the things that children do anyway. So when you see a child who's just playing or just watching you do something you're absorbed in, like cook, it turns out that child is actually using very powerful learning mechanisms to figure out how the world works and how you work and how your society works just by watching and just by playing. So watching and playing, which are the things that children just do naturally, turn out to be the most powerful learning mechanism.
You know, and we've talked a lot about, especially just a moment ago, about little kids, you know, watching you do this, playing, free play, learning important skills there. A colleague of mine asked me, who has two teenagers, she said, is it too late for me, you know, to adapt some of these ideas that you talk about, Professor Gopnik? Or, you know, are we done?
Well, one of the other reassuring and liberating messages from the science is that we're never done. So there's much more resilience and much more possibility for change, for plasticity, even in grown-ups than we would have thought before. And one of the interesting things that I talk about in the book is even for adults, going back to that childhood state of exploration and possibility and play helps us to make progress as adults. Now, of course, as grown-ups, we have this tension because we do have to be focused, expert, do things quickly and easily and automatically. We spend a lot of our time doing that, and we kind of need to get on in the world. We wouldn't really want to live in a world that was run by three-year-olds. But being a three-year-old for a little bit of time, whether it comes from meditating or being involved in brainstorming or just hanging out with three-year-olds, that actually does seem to help us to get some of that childhood creativity and innovation back again. And just the same way that it's hard to find time for play in a busy day, it can be hard in a society to find time for play and exploration in adults, even though in the world that we're facing now, a world of technological change, for example, those values of innovation and creativity are even more important. It's ironic that our education system and our attitude towards caregiving has become more and more directive, more and more controlling, more and more shaping, more and more doing the things that we know are just antithetical to innovation and creativity.
So when we know that creativity and innovation come out of that free play or that empty brain time, yet the world gets more rigid, you know, you will work, you know, this amount and you will sit in school these amount of hours and so forth. Companies like Google, for example, I visited the Google campus a couple years ago, and you know what I'm going to say, Professor Gopnik, you know, bicycles, places to juggle, places to play volleyball. We saw young people, you know, roaming around, playing kickball and so forth. And my kids were like, Mom, aren't they supposed to be working? So I said, I think this is part of the plan, but I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I think it's, again, interesting that if you go to a place like Google or Pixar, what you see is that in places that realize that innovation are really important, you know, Pixar has playhouses. Google gives people a chance once a week to do work on their own projects. So I think the irony is that you see children in high school who are supposed to be getting prepared for that life, who are doing, you know, 4 hours of homework and not sleeping because they want to be successful, and yet the world that they're being shaped for looks much more like the world of preschool. So we're doing, you know, the things that people in a place like Google are doing is kind of, again, recreating this preschool environment, a protected place where you can explore and find possibilities, and we're taking that away from the preschoolers who were the ones who were designed to do that the most.
Well, it's tough. I mean, again, you know, people listening might think, well, that's great for Google. They're a huge, you know, wealthy multinational. But in the meantime, I'm trying to run the local McDonald's and get the customers served, or I'm a lawyer and I've got a case tomorrow and I've got to get ready. And so it's easier said than done, isn't it?
Well, as I say, I think the challenge for adults is that we have to move back and forth between this, and this is true, as I know well at places like Google, too. We have to move back and forth between the creative part, and then you have to get your products to market. You have to get things done. You have to focus. You have to have these capacities for long-term planning. So part of being an adult, and I talk about the scientific basis for this in the book, is going back and forth between these two ways of being in the world. But one of the things that goes back to the discussion about schooling is, you know, you could make an argument that schooling as we know it really was, again, very recent invention in the 19th century, and it was designed to get people to be robots. It was designed to get people to be able to do the same thing over and over again in an industrial setting. And the thing is, now robots are going to be robots. The kinds of skills that we needed to have someone who could work on a factory floor aren't going to be the skills that we need for the future, because we'll have robots who will be able to do those things on the factory floor. And the things that the robots can't do, like innovate and be creative, those are the things that are going to be most valuable. Those are the things that come naturally to preschoolers and even to teenagers, and we should be letting those things flourish rather than shutting them down.
Well, earlier in our conversation, Professor Gopnik, you lamented the large number of parenting books out there. And you said, in fact, you don't even like the word parenting. Still, to some extent, this is a parenting book, albeit a very sciencey one. It's probably on the parenting shelf at the local bookstore. What's the one message that you hope parents do take away from this book?
Well, I think it can be encapsulated in the idea that what we need to do is to be a parent instead of parenting. So the relationship between parents and children is really deep, and the way that very young children learn and develop is one of the most amazing things that happens on the planet, and I think maybe in the universe. It's this incredible thing. Every single child goes out into the world, learns, explores, creates something new. And when you're a parent, you have a chance to be, you know, you have a front row seat on this amazing process, and you get to be part of it. And I think if parents could focus more on the here and now, think about what will make me and my child thrive at this moment, rather than always worrying about what's the effect of this going to be 20 years from now, and pretty hard to predict what the effect will be 20 years from now. I think that would lead to the act of being a parent being more satisfying and less anxious, both for parents and for children. So insofar as parents can focus on how great it is to be a parent now, I think that's the thing that will help in the long run. Ironically enough, that's the thing that will bring about the best consequences in the long run.
Well, advice of a grandmother and an author and a psychology professor, Allison Gopnik, really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.